Behind them, there was the sound of bullock carts tearing free. The syce stood hovering to say the way was clear, the press extremely great, and the horses in a muck sweat. "Stephen," she said, "I cannot stay. Come and see me. I must tell you where I live. Do you know Malabar Hill?"
I know," said Stephen, meaning that he knew where she lived, knew her house well.
But she paid no attention in the hurry of her thoughts and went on, "No, you'll certainly get lost." She turned to Dill. "Dost know the giant temple beyond the Black Pagoda, the palace of Jaswant Rao, and then the Satara Tower?" A rapid, intricate series of directions. Dill's expression was reserved, slightly cynical, patronizing, knowing. It was clear that only politeness kept her from cutting them short, from crying with Stephen, "But I know, I know." "Then through the garden. He will certainly be lost without a wise hand to guide him, so bring him tomorrow night, I pray, and thou shalt have 3 wishes."
"Certainly he needs guidance."
The carriage door slammed. The syce heaved up the steps. From out of the rigidly assumed discretion, the 3 officers stole secret glances at the glassy. The barouche melted into the sea of moving forms. For a few moments, the apricot umbrellas could still be seen, and then they were gone. Stephen felt the weight of Dill's unwinking scrutiny. He scratched himself in silence and listened to the now violent pounding of his heart. "Oh, oh, oh!" she cried at last, rising and placing her thin hands together like a temple dancer. "Oh, oh, I understand it now!" She writhed and stamped and swayed, chanting, "Oh, Krishna, Krishnaji, oh, Stephen Bahadur, Sivaji, oh, merchant of hearts, ha, ha, ha!" Her mirth overcame her dancing, and she fell to the ground. "Dost thou understand?"
"Perhaps not quite as well as thou."
"I shall explain, make clear. She is wooing thee. She wishes to see thee by night. Oh, shameless! But why, when she has 3 husbands? Because she must have a 4th, like the Tibetans. They have 4 husbands, and the Frank women are very like Tibetans. Strange, strange ways. The 3 have not given her a child, so a 4th there must be, and she has chosen thee because thou art so unlike them. She was warned in a dream, no doubt, told where to find thee so unlike the rest."
"Wholly unlike?"
"Oh, yes, yes, they are fools. It's written on their foreheads, and they are rich and thou art poor. They are young and thou art ancient. They are handsome, red-faced men, and thou... Most holy men are hideous, though more or less innocent." "Horns and trumpets! Hurry, come, hurry! We must run down to the sea!"
Stephen walked into the silversmith's alley, a lane even narrower than most, with awnings spread against the fierce declining sun. The heat was filled with an incessant clicking, not unlike an insect stridulation. On either side of the alley, the smiths worked at filigree, nose rings, anklets, bracelets, stomachers, each in his own open cupboard of a shop. Some had braziers with pipes to direct the flame, and the smell of charcoal drifted along the ground. He sat down to watch a boy polishing his work on a crazy wheel that splashed red liquid into the lane.
"I am extremely unwilling that Dill should accompany me," he reflected, "and myself dressed in European clothes."
The shadow of a Brahmin bull fell over him, and the stall, making the brazier glow pink. It thrust its muzzle into his bosom, snuffled, and moved on.
"I get so sick of lies. I've been surrounded with them and with deception in one form or another for so long. Disguise and subterfuge. A dangerous trade. The taint must come through at last.
There are some, and Diana is one, I believe, who have a separate truth of their own. Ordinary people, Sophie and myself, for example, are nothing without the ordinary truth, nothing at all. They die without it, without innocence and candour. Indeed, the very great majority kill themselves long, long before their time. Live as children, grow pale as adolescents, show a flash of life in love, die in their 20s, and join the poor things that creep angry and restless about the earth. Dill is alive. This boy is living. For some time the boy, a creature with huge eyes, had been smiling at him between bracelets. They were well acquainted before Stephen said, "Boy, wilt thou tell me the cost of those bracelets?" "Pandit," said the boy, his teeth flashing, "the truth is my mother and my father. I will not lie to thee. There are bracelets for every degree of wealth." When he found Dill, she was playing a game so like the hopscotch of his youth that he felt the stirring of that ancient anxiety as the flat stone shuffled across the lines towards paradise. One of her companions hopped, exulting, to the goal itself, her anklets clashing as she went. "But it was false," cried Dill. "She'd not hopped fair. A blind hyena could have seen her stagger and touch the ground." Glaring about with clenched fists to call heaven and earth to witness, she caught sight of Stephen and abandoned the match, calling out as she left them that they were daughters of whores, they would be barren all their lives. "Shall we go now?" she asked. "Art so very eager, Stephen?" She found the notion of Stephen as a bridegroom irresistibly comic. "No," he said. "Oh, no. I know the way. I've been there many times. I have another service to beg of thee, to take this letter to the ship." Her face clouded. She pushed out her lower lip. Her whole body expressed displeasure and negation. "Thou art not afraid to take it in the dark?" he asked, glancing at the sun no more than its own breadth above the sea. "Bah!" she cried, kicking the ground. "I want to go with thee. Besides, if I do not go with thee, where are my three wishes? There is no justice in the world." It had never been difficult to make out the nature of Dill's wishes, whatever their number. From the first day of their friendship, she had spoken of bracelets, silver bracelets. She had told him, objectively and at length, the size, weight, and quality of every kind in the presidency, as well as those current in the neighbouring province and kingdoms, and he had seen her kick more than one well-furnished, clanking child from mere envy. They walked to a grove of coconut palms, overlooking Elephanta Island. "I have never yet seen the caves," he observed, and took a cloth parcel from his bosom. As though she too had been warned in a dream, Dill stopped breathing and watched with motionless intensity. "Here is the first wish," he said, taking out one bangle. "Here is the second," taking out two. "And here is the third," taking out three more. She reached forward a hesitant hand and touched them lightly. Her fearless and cheerful expression was now timid, very grave. She held one for a moment, put it solemnly down, looked at Stephen gazing at the island in the bay, put it silently on, and squatted there amazed, staring at her arm and the gleaming band of silver. Put on another, and another, and the rapture of possession seized her. She burst into wild laughter, slipped them all on, all off, all on in a different order, patting them, talking to them, giving them each a name. She leapt up and spun, jerking her thin arms to make the bracelets clink. Then suddenly she dropped in front of Stephen and worshipped him for a while, patting his feet. Earnest, loving thanks, broken by exclamations. How had he known? Preternatural wisdom nothing to him, of course. Did he think them better this way round or that? Such a blaze of light! Might she have the cloth they were wrapped in? She took them off, comforting them. Put them on again. How smoothly they slipped. And sat there, pressed against his knee, gazing at the silver on her arms.
"Child," he said, "the sun has set. It is the dark of the moon, and we must go."
"Instantly," she cried, "give me the chit, and I fly to the ship, straight to the ship, ha ha ha!" She ran, skipping down the hill. He watched her until she vanished in the twilight. Her gleaming arms held out like wings, and the letter grasped in her mouth. He had seen the house often enough from the outside, was familiar with its walls, windows, entrances. A retired house, deep behind its courts and inner walled gardens, but he was surprised to find how large it was inside. A small palace, in fact, not so large as the commissioner's residence, but very much finer, being made of white marble, cool and intricately fretted in the room where he stood, an octagonal room, domed with a fountain in the middle of it. Under the dome, a gallery, screened with this same marble lace. A staircase curving down from the gallery to the place where Stephen stood. And on the fifth step above him, three small pots, a brass pan for gathering filth. On the sixth, a short brush made of finely divided toddy palm frond, and a longer brush, virtually a broom. A scorpion had hidden under the pan, but it didn't judge the shelter adequate, and he was watching its uneasy movements among the pots. Moving between them, it balanced its claws and tail, rising on its legs with a certain grace. At the sound of voices, he looked up. Shapes could be seen flitting through the pierced gallery, and Diana, followed by another woman, appeared at the top of the stairs. Most women show at a disadvantage viewed from below, not Diana. She was dressed in light blue muslin trousers, tight at the ankle, and a sleeveless jacket above a deep, deep blue sash. Remarkably tall and slim, the foreshortening effect quite overcome. She cried, "Maturin!" and ran down the stairs. She caught her right foot on the pan and her left on the handle of the larger brush. The impetus of her run carried her clear of the remaining implements, the remaining stairs, and Stephen caught her at the bottom. He held her lithe body in his arms, kissed her on both cheeks, and set her on her feet.
"Pray take notice of the scorpion, ma'am," he called to the elderly woman on the stairs. "He is beneath the little broom."
"Maturin," cried Diana again. "I'm still amazed to see you, utterly amazed. It's impossible you should be standing here. Much more astonishing than sitting there in the crowd by the fort like a dream. Lady Forbes, may I introduce Dr. Maturin? Dr. Maturin, Lady Forbes, who is so kind as to live with me." She was a dumpy woman, dressed in a haphazard way with ornaments here and there, but she'd taken great care over her large face, which was painted out of resemblance to humanity, and with her wig whose curls stood in order low on her forehead. She recovered from her deep curtsy, saying, "He's an odd-looking bugger. A streak of the tar-brush, I dare say. God damn this leg, I shall never get up. How do you do, sir? So happy. Were you born a ninja, sir? I remember some Maturins on the Coromandel coast." Diana clapped her hands. Servants flowed into the room. Exclamations of deep and even tragic concern at her danger and at the mess. Soft, deprecating murmurs. Bows, anxiety, gentle, immovable obstinacy. At last an aged person was brought in, and he carried the pan away. The scorpion was removed in wooden tweezers. Two different servants gathered up what was left. "Forgive me, Maturin," she said. "You cannot imagine what it is keeping house with so many different castes. One cannot touch this, another cannot touch that. And half of them are only copycats. Such stuff! Of course, a Radovalami can touch a pot. However, let's try whether they can give us anything to wet our whistles with. Have you eaten yet, Maturin?"
"I have not," he said.
She clapped her hands again. A fresh company appeared, a score of different people. And while Diana was issuing her orders, there was more wrangling, exhortation and laughter than he would have expected outside Ireland, he turned to Lady Forbes and said, "It is remarkably cool here, ma'am."
"Wrangle, wrangle, wrangle," said Lady Forbes. "She has no idea of managing her servants, never had when she was a girl."
"Yes, sir. It is sunk for the purpose, quite underground, you know.
God's my life, I hope she calls for the champagne. I'm fair parched.
Won't you think this young fellow worth it?"
"Aye, there's the point. Canning's very near with his wine.
But there is the inconvenience that it floods. I remember 2 feet of mud on the floor in Raghunath Rao's time, for it belonged to him then, you know. However, there was really no rain this monsoon, no rain at all, hardly. Presently there will be another famine in Gujarat, and the tedious creatures will be dying off in droves and making one's morning ride so disagreeable." The parts of her conversation that were intended for herself were uttered in a deeper tone, but there was no variation in the volume of sound. "Villas," he said, "pray, what language were you speaking to them?"
"That was Bangabasa. They speak it in Bengal. I brought some of my father's people back when I was in Calcutta.
But come, tell me about your voyage. A good passage? What did you come in?"
"A frigate. The Surprise."
"Such a good name. You could have..." "Don't beat me if I say knock me down with a feather. When I saw you in that wicked old shirt on the glassy, exactly what I should have expected you to wear in this climate. So much more sensible than broadcloth. Do you admire my trousers?"
"Extremely."
"Surprise! Well, you astonish me. Admiral Harvey did speak of a frigate with a nephew of his on board, but he said the Nemesis. Is Aubrey in command? Of course he must be, or you wouldn't be here. Is he married yet? I saw the announcement in the Times, but no marriage yet."
"I believe it is to be any minute now."
"All my Williams cousins will be married," she observed with a slight check in her bubbling gaiety. "Here's the champagne at last. Lord, I could do with a glass. I hope you're as thirsty as I am, Maturin. Let's drink to his health and happiness." "With all my heart." "Tell me," said Diana, "has he grown up at all?"
"I don't think that you would see a greater maturity," said Stephen. "As I grow older, so I coarsen," he thought, emptying his glass.
A greybeard with a silver mace advanced towards Diana, bowed and thumped 3 times. Immediately low tables came hurrying in, and great silver trays with innumerable dishes, most of them very small.
"You'll forgive me, my dear," said Lady Forbes, rising. "You know I never sup."
"Of course," said Diana. "And as you pass by, would you be very kind and see that everything's ready? Dr. Maturin will be staying in the lapis lazuli room." They sat on a divan with the tables grouped in front of them. She explained the dishes with great volubility and a fair amount of open greed. "You'll not mind eating in the Indian way. I love it." She was in tearing high spirits, laughing and talking away at a splendid rate, as though she had been long deprived of company.
"How it becomes her to laugh," he reflected. "Dulce loquentem, dulce ridentem. Most women are solemn owls. But then few have such brilliant teeth."
He said, "How many teeth have you in your head now, Villas?"
"Lord, I don't know. How many should I have? They're all there, in any event. Ha! He's given us vidpachata. How I loved it as a child. Still do. Let me help you. Do you think Aubrey would like to dine here with his officers? I could ask the Admiral. He's a vicious man, but he can be vastly pleasant when he chooses. Fool of a wife, but then so many naval wives are impossible, and some of the dockyard people. Just men.
I cannot answer for him, of course, but I do know he's much taken up with his ship. She is being heaved up and heaved down. Vital pieces are being sawed out of her bowels. She was much shattered south of the Cape. He has refused all invitations apart from the Admiral's dinner, and that was a holiday of obligation. Oh, well, damn Aubrey.
But I can't tell you how glad I am to see you, Stephen. I've been so lonely. And you were in my mind as clear as a bell just before I saw you.
You're no great shakes at eating in the Indian way, I see.
Oh, my God, what have you done with your poor hands?
It is of no consequence, said Stephen, darting them out of sight. They were injured, caught in a machine. It is of no consequence. It will soon pass.
I will feed you. She sat cross-legged on a cushion in front of him, dipping into a dozen bowls, dishes, plates, and feeding him with balls that exploded in a pink glow inside his stomach, others that cooled and dulcified his palate. He looked attentively at her firm, round legs under the blue muslin, and the play of her loins as she leant from side to side or towards him. "What was that thin child I saw you with?" she asked. "A daktari, too pale for a gone, she spoke poor Urdu.
I never asked her, nor did she question me. Tell me, Venice, what must I do? I wish to ensure that she will eat to her hunger every day. At present she begs or steals most of her food. I may buy her for 12 rupees, so the thing should be simple, but it is not. I don't wish to put her into a way of earning an honest living. Plying her needle, for example, she has no needle, nor does she feel the need for one. Nor do I wish to entrust her to the good Portuguese sisters to be clothed and converted. Yet surely there must be some solution.
I'm sure there is, said Diana. But I should have to know much more about her before I could say anything of the least real use. Her caste, and so on. You never believe the difficulties that can cause when you're thinking of a place for a child. She may be an untouchable, probably is. Send her whenever you have any message for me, and then I can find out. In the meantime, she must certainly come here if ever she's hungry. We shall find a way, I'm sure. But you'll be a great simpleton if you pay 12 rupees, Stephen. 3 is more than mark. Another piece?
If you please. And don't let us neglect the pale ale at your elbow.
Ales, sherbet, mangosteens. The sky itself turned pale while they talked of Indian pastry cooks. The frigate's voyage, her purpose and intent. Mr. Stanhope, sloths, the great men of Bombay. Her only references to Canning were oblique. On her good days, Lady Forbes can be an entertaining companion. And at all events, she keeps me in countenance. I need it, you know.
And
I rode 60 miles the day before yesterday, and 60 the day before that, right over to the Ghauts. That was why I was here so much earlier than I'd expected. There was some tedious business to be discussed with the Nizam, and suddenly I couldn't bear it any longer and came on alone, leaving the elephants and camels to follow. They should be here on the 17th.
Many elephants and camels?
No, 30 elephants and maybe 100 of camels. Bullock carts, too, naturally, but even a small train takes an endless time to get moving. You run mad and start to scream.
And do you indeed travel with 30 elephants?
This was only a small journey. To Hyderabad, no more. When we go right across, we take 100 and all the rest in proportion. It's like an army. Those... Stephen, I wish you could have seen half the things I saw this last time. Leopards by the dozen, all kinds of birds and monkeys, a python that had eaten a deer, and a well-grown young tiger. Not up to our Bengal standards, but a tolerable fine beast. Tell me, Stephen, what can I show you? This is my country, after all, and I should love to lead you about. I'm my own mistress for the next few days.
God bless you, my dear. I should like to see the caves of Elephanta, if you please.
a bamboo forest, and a tiger. Elephanta, I can promise. We'll make up a party at the end of the week and ask Mr. Stanhope. He's a charming man, prodigious gallant to me in London, and your parson, friend. The bamboo forest, too. The tiger I will not swear to. I'm sure the Peshwar will try to drive one for us in the Poona Hills, but they have had rain there, and with the jungle so thick. However, if we do miss of a tiger there, I can promise you half a dozen in Bengal. For when you've set the old gentleman down in Kampong, you must come back to Calcutta, I collect. Perhaps it was a mistake to invite Mr. Stanhope. The day was intolerably hot and humid. All he wanted to do was to lie on his bed with a punkah sighing over him, at least moving the unbreathable air. But he thought it his duty to wait on Mrs. Villiers, and he particularly wished to see Dr. Maturin, who had unaccountably vanished these last days. So, overcoming his nausea and putting a little carmine on his yellow cheeks, he embarked on the heavy, oily swell, and there being no hint of a breeze, they rowed him the 6 evil miles across the bay. Mr. Atkins sat by him, and in a rapid, excited whisper he told His Excellency of the discoveries he had made. Mr. Atkins was never long in any community before he mastered all the gossip. He had found out, he said, that this Mrs. V. was not a respectable person, that she was, in fact, the mistress of a Jew merchant, a Jew, for God's sake, and that her impudent presence in Bombay aroused indignation, that Dr. Maturin was aware of the couple's criminal conversation, and that he had therefore betrayed Mr. Stanhope into a false position, His Majesty's representative giving countenance to a connection of this sort. Mr. Stanhope said little in reply, but when he landed he was stiffer and more reserved than usual. In spite of his elaborate courtesy to Diana, his praise for the magnificent array of tents, umbrellas, carpets, cooling drinks, which reminded him of Ascot, for the lumpish statue of the elephant, and the astonishing, astonishing wealth of sculpture in the caves, his want of cordial enjoyment affected the whole company. He called Stephen aside as they were walking to the caves and said, "I'm very much disturbed in my mind, Dr. Maturin. I have word from Captain Aubrey that we are to embark on the 17th. I'd counted upon at least another 3 weeks. Dr. Clow's course of bleeding and slime baths lasts another 3 weeks." "This must be some extravagant, wild flight of naval hyperbole. How often do we not read of passengers urged to appear on board at, let us say, Greenwich or the Downs on a given date, only to find that the mariners have not the least intention of sailing, either for want of inclination or even for the want of the very sails themselves. You may set your mind at rest, sir. To my certain knowledge, the Surprise was without her masts only a very short time ago. It is materially impossible she should sail on the 17th. I wonder at his precipitancy." "Have you seen Captain Aubrey recently?" "I have not. Nor, to my shame, have I called upon Dr. Clowes since Friday. Have you found benefit from his slime?" "Dr. Clowes and his colleagues are excellent physicians, I'm sure, and they are most attentive, but they do not seem to have prevailed with the liver complaint. They're afraid it may fly to the stomach and fix itself there. However, my main purpose in begging for these few moments was to tell you that we've received overland dispatches on which I should value your advice. And may I at the same time hint that perhaps you've not been quite as assiduous in attending at the office as ideal perfection might require? We've been unable to find you these last days, in spite of repeated applications to the ship and to your lodgings in town. No doubt your berths have drawn you away, have seduced you from your usual exact punctuality. I beg pardon, Your Excellency. I shall attend this afternoon, and at the same time we can discuss your liver with Dr. Close. I should be most infinitely obliged, Dr. Matron. But we're neglecting our duty in a most disgraceful manner. Dear Mrs. Villars, he cried, casting a haggard eye upon the feast spread in front of the caves. This is princely, princely! Lucullus dines with Lucullus, upon my word. Mr. White, the chaplain, to whom Atkins had at once communicated his discoveries, was as reserved as his patron. He was also deeply shocked by some of the female and hermaphrodite sculptures, and an unidentified creature had bitten him on the left buttock when he sat upon it. He remained heavy and stolid throughout the entertainment. Mr. Atkins and the young men of the envoy's suite were less affected by the atmosphere, however, and they made enough noise to give the impression of a party that was enjoying itself. Atkins more than any. He was easy and familiar, he talked loudly without restraint, and during the picnic he called out to Stephen not to let the bottle stand by him. It wasn't every day they could swill champagne. After it, he led Diana to a particularly striking group at the back of the second cave, and holding up a lamp, he desired her to take notice of the flowing curves, the delicious harmony, the balance, worthy of the well-known Greek sculpture Phidias. She was astonished at his assurance, the way in which he held her elbow and breathed on her. But supposing that he was in wine, she didn't formalize upon it, only detached herself, regretted that she had been so simple as to follow him, and rejoiced at the sight of Stephen hurrying towards them. Mr. Atkins continued in high spirits, however, and when the party broke up on the Bombay shore, he thrust his head into her palanquin and said, "I shall come up and see you one of these evenings," adding with an arch look that left her speechless, "I know where you live." Later that day, Stephen returned to the house on Malabar Hill and said to Diana, "Mr. Stanhope desires his best compliments to Mrs. Villars and his heartfelt thanks for an unforgettably delightful afternoon. Lady Forbes, your servant. Do not you find it uncommon hot, ma'am?" Lady Forbes gave him a vague, frightened smile, and presently she left the room. "Maturin, did you ever know such a wretched, miserable damn picnic in your life?" said Diana. She was wearing an ugly, hard blue dress, tediously embroidered with pearls, and a rope of very much larger pearls in a loop to her middle. "But it was kind of him to send his compliments, his best compliments, to a fallen woman." "What stuff you talk, Villars," he said. "I have fallen pretty low for an odious little reptile like that Perkins to take such liberties. Christ, Maturin, this is a vile life. I never go out without the danger of an affront, and I'm alone, cooped up in this foul place all the time. There are only half a dozen women who receive me willingly, and four of them are demi-reps and the others charitable fools. Such company I keep. And the other women I meet, particularly those I knew in India before, oh, how they know how to place their darts. Nothing obvious, because I can hit back and Canning could break their husbands, but sharp enough and poisonous. My God, you have no notion what bitches women are. It makes me so furious I can't sleep. I get ill, I'm bilious with rage, and I look 40. In 6 months I shall not be fit to be seen." "Sure, my dear, you deceive yourself. The first moment I saw you, I remarked that your complexion was even finer than it was in England. This impression was confirmed when I came here and examined it at leisure. I wonder that you should be so easily taken in. It is only so much trompe-couillon, as Amélie calls it. She's the best woman painter since what's her name? Vigée Lebrun? No. Jezebel. Look here," she cried, drawing a finger down her cheek and showing a faint smear of pink. Stephen looked at it closely. He shook his head. "No, that is not the essence at all. Though in passing, I must warn you against the use of ceruse. It may desiccate and wrinkle the deeper layers. Hog's lard is more to the point. No, the essence is your spirit, courage, intelligence, and gaiety. They are unaffected. And it is they that form your face. You are responsible for your face. But how long do you think any woman's spirit can last in this kind of life? They dare not use me so badly when Canning is here. But he's so often away, going to Mahay and so on, and then when he is here there are these perpetual scenes, often to the point of a break. And if we break, can you imagine my future? Penniless in Bombay? It's unthinkable. Oh, he's a kind keeper. I don't say he's not. But he's so hellish jealous. Get out! She shouted at a servant in the doorway. Get out! Again, as he lingered, making deprecatory gestures. And she shied a decanter at his head. It's so humiliating to be suspected, she said. I know half the servants are set to watch. If I didn't stand up for myself, there'd be a troop of black eunuchs, great flabby things, in no time at all. That's why I have my own people. Oh, I get so tired of these scenes. Travelling is the only thing that is even half bearable. Going somewhere else. It's an impossible situation for a woman with any spirit. Do you remember what I told you a great while ago about married men being the enemy? Here I am, delivered up to the enemy, bound hand and foot. Of course it's my own fault. You don't have to tell me of it. But that doesn't make the life any less wretched. Living large is very well. And certainly I love a rope of pearls as much as any woman. But give me even a grisly, damp, cold English cottage. I'm sorry, said he in a harsh, formal voice, that you should not be happy. But at least it does give me some slightly greater confidence, a perceptibly greater justification in making my proposal. Are you going to take me into keeping too, Stephen? She asked with a smile. No, he said, endeavouring to imitate her. He privately crossed his bosom, and then, speaking somewhat at random in his agitation, he went on, I have never made a woman an offer of marriage. I'm ignorant of the accepted forms. I'm sorry for my ignorance. But I beg you will have the goodness, the very great goodness, to marry me. As she did not reply, he added, It would oblige me extremely, Diana. Why, Stephen? She said at last, still gazing at him with candid wonder. Upon my word and honour, you astonish me. I can hardly speak. It was the kindest thing you could possibly have said to me. But your friendship, your affection is leading you away. It is your dear good heart full of pity for a friend that— No, 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 he cried passionately. This is a deliberate, long-meditated statement, conceived a great while since and matured over 12,000 miles and more. I am painfully aware, he said, clasping and unclasping his hands behind his back, that my appearance does not serve me, that there are objections to my person, my birth, and my religion, and that my fortune is nothing in comparison with that of a wealthy man, but I am not the penniless nonentity I was when we first met. I can offer an honourable, if not a brilliant, marriage, and at the very lowest I can provide my wife, my widow, my relict, with a decent competence, an assured future. Stephen, darling, you honour me beyond what I can express. You are the dearest man I know, by so very far my best friend. But you know I often speak like a fool when I'm angry, fly out farther than I mean. I'm an ill-tempered woman, I'm afraid. I'm deeply engaged to Canning. He's been extremely good to me. And what kind of a wife can I make for you? You should have married Sophie. She would have been content with very little.
and you would never have been ashamed of her. Ashamed? Think what I've been. Think what I am now. And London isn't far from Bombay. The gossip is the same in both. And having had this kind of life again, could I ever... Stephen, are you unwell?
I was going to say there is Barcelona, Paris, even Dublin.
You are certainly unwell. You look ghastly. Take off your coat, sit in your shirt and breeches.
Sure, I have never felt the heat so much.
He threw off his coat and neckcloth. Drink some iced water and put your head down. Dear Stephen, I wish I could make you happy. Pray don't look so wretched. Perhaps, you know, if it were to come to a break...
And then again, he said, as though 10 silent minutes hadn't passed, it is not a question of very little by European standards. I have about £10,000, I believe, an estate worth as much again, and capable of improvement. There is also my pay, he added, 200 or 300 a year.
And a castle in Spain, said Diana, smiling. Lie still and tell me about your castle in Spain. I know it has a marble bath.
Aye, and a marble roof, where it has a roof at all. But I must not practice on you, Villas. It is not what you have here. 5 habitable rooms. And most of them are inhabited by merino sheep. It is a romantic ruin surrounded by romantic mountains. But romance doesn't keep the rain away.
He had made his attempt, delivered his charge, and it had failed. Now his heart beat quietly again. He was speaking in a companionable, detached voice about merino sheep, the peculiarities of a Spanish rent roll, the inconveniences of war, the sailor's chances of prize money. And he was reaching for his neckcloth when she interrupted him and said, "Stephen, what you said to me turned my head about so much I hardly know what I answered. I must think. Let's talk about it again in Calcutta. I must have months and months to think." "Lord, how pale you've gone again. Come, put on a light gown and we'll sit in the court for the fresh air. These lamps are intolerable indoors."
"No, no. Do not move."
"Why?" "Because it's Canning's gown? Because he's my lover? Because he's a Jew?"
"Stuff! I have the greatest esteem for Jews, so far as anyone can speak of a heterogeneous great body of men in such a meaningless, illiberal way."
Canning walked into the room, a big man who moved lightly on his feet.
"How long has he been outside?" thought Stephen.
And Diana said, "Canning, Dr. Maturin finds the heat a little much. I'm trying to persuade him to put on a gown and to sit by the fountain in the Peacock Court. You remember Dr. Maturin?"
"Perfectly. And I'm very happy to see him.
But, my dear sir, I'm concerned that you should not be entirely well. It is indeed a most oppressive day. Pray give me your arm and we'll take the air. I can do with it myself. Diana, will you call for a gown or perhaps a shawl?"
"How much does he know about me?"
wondered Stephen as they sat there in the relative coolness, Canning and Diana talking quietly of his journey, the Nizam, and of Mr. Norton. It seemed that Mr. Norton's best friend had run away into the Nizam's dominions with Mrs. Norton.
"He gives nothing away," Stephen reflected. "But that in itself is significant. And he has not asked after Jack, which is more so. His bluff, manly air cannot be assumed, however. It's very like Jack's, and it certainly represents a great deal of the man.
but I also perceive a gleam of hidden intelligence. How I wish he had Lady Forbes's gift of displaying his secret mind. "Mr. Norton, the ornithologist?" he asked aloud. "No," said Diana, "he's interested in birds." "So interested," said Canning, "that he went off as far as Bicarnia for a kind of sand-grouse, and when he came back Mrs. Norton had flown. I don't think it a pretty thing to seduce a friend's wife." "I'm sure you're right," said Stephen. "But is it indeed a possible offence? A booby girl may be led away by a wicked fellow, to be sure, but a woman, a married woman? For my part, I do not believe that any marriage was ever yet broken by an outside force. Let us suppose that Mrs. Norton is confronted with a choice between claret and port. She decides that she does not care for claret, but that she does care for port. From that moment she is wedded to her muddy brew, and it is impertinent to assure her that claret is her true delight. Nor does it seem to me that any great blame attaches to the bottle she prefers." "If only there were a breath of air from the sea," said Canning with his deep belly laugh, "I should tear your analogy limb from limb. Besides, you'd never have ventured upon it, a foul bottom if ever there was one. But my point is that Norton was Morton's particular friend. Norton took him into his house, and he made his way into Norton's bed." "That was not pretty, I must confess. It savours of impiety." "I've not asked after our friend Aubrey," cried Canning. "Have you news of him? I believe we're to drink to his happiness. Perhaps we should even do so now." "He is here in Bombay. His frigate, the Surprise, is refitting in Bombay."
"You astonish me," said Canning.
"I doubt that very much, my friend," said Stephen inwardly. He listened to Canning's exclamations upon the service, its ubiquity, its wide commitments, Jack's excellence as a sailor, sincere and reiterated hopes for his happiness, and then he stood up, saying he believed he must beg permission to withdraw. It was some time since he had been to his lodgings, and work was waiting for him there. His lodgings were near the yard. He looked forward to the walk.
"You can't walk all the way to the dockyard," said Canning. "I shall send for a palanquin."
"You are very good, but I prefer to walk."
"But, my dear sir, it's madness to stroll about Bombay at this time of night. You'd certainly be knocked on the head. Believe me, it's a very dangerous city."
Stephen was not easily overcome, but Canning obliged him to accept an escort. And it was at the head of a train of bearded, sabre-bearing Sikhs that he paced through the deserted outer streets, not altogether pleased with himself. Yet I like the man, and do not entirely grudge him the satisfaction of knowing that I am off the scene, and that I do in fact live at such and such an address. Down the hill, with the funeral pyres glowing on the shore, the scent of burning flesh and sandalwood, through quiet avenues tenanted by sleeping holy cows, pariah dogs and one gaunt, leafless tree covered with roosting kites, vultures, crows, through the bazaars, filled now by shrouded figures lying on the ground, through the brothel quarter by the port. Life here, several competing musics, bands of wandering sailors, but not a surprise among them. Then the long, quiet stretch outside the wall of the yard. And as they turned a corner, they fell upon a band of moplas gathered in a ring. The moplas straightened, hesitated, gauging their strength, and then fled, leaving a body on the ground. Stephen bent over it, holding the Sikh's lantern. There was nothing he could do, and he walked on. From a distance he was surprised to see a light burning in their house, and he was more surprised on walking in to find Bondon there, fast asleep. He was leaning over the table with his head on his bandaged arms,
and both arms and head were covered with an ashy snow. The innumerable flying creatures that had been drawn to the lamp. A troop of geckos stood on the table to eat the dazzled moths.
"Here you are at last, sir," he cried, starting up, scattering the geckos and his load of dead. "I'm right glad to see you."
"It is kind in you to say so, Bondon," said Stephen.
"What is up?"
"All hell is up, sir, pardon the expression. The captain's in a terrible taking over you, sir. Reefers and ship's boys relaying one another here. Messengers sent up every hour. Was you there yet? But I feared to go back and say no, you wasn't, and no word either. Poor Mr. Babington in irons, and young Mr. Church in callow, flogged in the cabin with his own hands. And didn't he half lay it on my eye? They howled as piteous as cats."
"Why, what's afoot?"
"What's afoot? Only blue murder, that's all. No liberty, all shore leave stopped, barky warped out into the basin, no bumboats allowed alongside for a drop of refreshment, and all hands at it working double tides, officers too. No liberty at all, though promised weeks ago. You remember how the old Caesar got a new mast in by firelight in jib before our brush with the Spaniards? Well, it was like that, only day after day after bleeding day. Every hand that could hail on a rope, sick or not. Gangs of lascars which he hired in personal, drafts from the flagship, riggers from the yard. It was like a fucking ant heap, begging your pardon, and all in the flaming sun. No duff on Sunday. Not a soul allowed on shore, bar shrimps that was no use aboard, and these here messengers at the double, which I shouldn't be here myself, but with my arm.
What was it?
Boiling tar, sir. Hot and hot off the foretop. But nothing to what the captain's been ladling out. We reckon he must have word of Lenoir. But at any rate, it has been drive, drive, drive. Not a dead eye turned in on Tuesday, and yet we rattle down the shrouds today and we sail on tomorrow's tide. Admiral didn't believe it possible. I didn't believe it possible, nor yet the oldest forecastleman. And like I said or meant to say, Mr. Rattray took to his bed the Monday, wore out and sick, which half the rest of the people would have done the same if they dared. And all the time it was, 'Where's the doctor? God damn you, sir, can't you find the doctor, you perishing swab?' Right vexed he was. Excellency's baggage aboard in double-quick time, guns for the boats every 5 minutes, ball over their heads to encourage him to stretch out. God love us all. Here's a chit he gave me for you, sir.
Surprise, Bombay. Sir, you are hereby required and directed to report aboard HM ship under my command immediately upon receipt of this order. I am, etc., John Aubrey.
It's dated 3 days ago, observed Stephen.
Yes, sir. We've been handing it from one to the next by turns. Ned Hyde spilt some toddy on the corner.
Well, I shall read it tomorrow. I can hardly see tonight.
And we must get a couple of hours sleep before sunrise.
And does he indeed mean to sail upon the tide?
Lord, yes, sir. We must single anchor in the channel. Excellencies aboard, powder hoy alongside, and the last barrel stowing when I left her.
Dear me. Well, cut along to the ship now, Bondon. My compliments to the captain, and I shall be with him before the full.
Why do you stand there, Barrett Bondon, like a stock or image?
Sir, he'll call me a lubber and a fool, and I don't know what at all if I come back without you. And I'll tell you straight, it'll be a file of marines to carry you back to the ship the moment he knows you're here. I've followed him these many years, sir, and I've never known him so outrageous. Lions ain't in it.
Well, I shall be there before she sails. You needn't hurry to the ship, you know, he said, pushing the unwilling, anxious, despondent Bondon out of the door and locking it behind him.
Tomorrow would be the 17th. There might be other factors, but he was certain that one reason for this furious drive was Jack's desire to get him out of Bombay before Canning and Diana should return. No doubt he meant it kindly. No doubt he was afraid of an encounter between the two men. It was an ingenious piece of manipulation. But although Stephen was under naval law, he was not to be moved about quite so easily. He'd never cared for laws at any time. He threw off his clothes, poured water over himself,
and sat down to write a note to Diana. It would not do. It hit the wrong tone. Another version, and the sweat running down his fingers blurred the words. Canning was a formidable enemy. Sharp, silent, quick. If, indeed, he was an enemy at all. The danger of overreaching oneself. Byzantine convolutions, too cunning by half. The nausea of perpetual suspicion and intrigue. A hopeless nostalgia for a plain, direct relationship, for cleanliness. He reached for another sheet. It appeared that the enemy was at sea. He begged pardon for not taking leave. Looked forward to a meeting in Calcutta. Reminded her of the promised tiger. Sent his compliments to Mr. Canning. And was sure he might confide his little protégé to her kindness. He was just about to purchase the child for... That puts me in mind of my purse, he said. He found it, the small cloth bag, hung it round his neck, and put on a kind of shirt. Out into the cooler, cleaner air. Through the streets again, more peopled now with the gardeners bringing in their fruit and vegetables. Barrows, asses, bullocks and camel carts making their way carefully through the grey darkness. Pariah dogs flitting behind them. In the bazaars there were small lamps everywhere, and the glow of braziers. A general stirring. People picking up their beds and carrying them indoors or turning them into stalls. On through the Garhwal Caravanserai, past the Franciscan church, past the Jain temple, to the alley where Dil lived. The alley was unusually crowded. Already there were people filling in from side to side, and it was only by urging a Brahmin bull in front of him that he was able to reach the triangular booth made of planks and wedged against a buttress. The old woman was sitting in front of it with a wavering lamp on her right side, a white-robed man on the other, Dil's body in front of her, partly covered with a piece of cloth. On the ground... A bowl with some marigolds in it and four brass coins. The people pressed in a half-circle facing her, listening gravely to a harsh, angry voice. He sat down in the second rank, went down with a grunt as though his legs had been cut from under him, and he felt intolerable pain rising in his heart. He had seen so much death that he could not be mistaken. But after some time the hard acceptance he had learnt cleared his mind at least. The old woman was calling upon the crowd for money, breaking off to tell the Brahmin that a very little wood would do, wrangling with him, insisting. The people were kind. Many words of comfort, sympathy and praise. Small offerings added to the bowl. But it was a desperately poor neighbourhood, and the coins didn't amount to half a dozen logs.
"Here is no one of her caste," said the man next to Stephen.
And other people murmured that that was the cruel pity of the thing. Her own people would have seen to the fire. But with a famine coming, no man dared look beyond the caste he belonged to.
"I am of her caste," said Stephen to the man in front of him, touching his shoulder. "Tell the woman I will buy the child."
"Friend, tell the woman I will buy the child and take it down. I will attend to the fire." The man looked round at him. Stephen's eyes were remote, his cheeks hollow, lined, and dirty. His hair straggled over his face. He might well have been mad, or in another state, removed. The man glanced at his grave neighbours,